So we come this evening to the second in what I think is going to be a rather drawn-out series on the Temple of God. The first was a month or so ago, and the next one's probably not going to be for another month or so. So it's kind of one step at a time. The series then, as I think I've just mentioned, is the Temple of God. The Temple of God then meaning the dwelling place of God, the place where the Lord made himself available for men and women to meet with him and worship him. And we began last time then by considering the Garden of Eden, the garden then as the first temple, the garden temple of the Lord. There at the beginning, that there was this distinction between the garden, and the word used was an interesting one that could mean something like a garden temple or Royal Park temple, and there's a distinction anyway between that and the rest of earth. Earth was all good, but it wasn't the garden. That was paradise. That was the place where the Lord walked with man. Man met with God. It was a place where there seemed to have been cherubim. Certainly they guarded it at the end. It was the place where there seemed to be riches, where there were certainly plentiful trees and so on. And these kinds of features then mark that paradise, that garden temple then, where man dwelt with God and had access to God. But of course that didn't last for long. We don't know how long it lasted for, but with man's sin, in eating the fruit, then he, Adam and Eve, were banned from the garden, and they were sent out that east exit and down the mountain somewhere, because we saw also that the Garden of Eden was on a mountain. It was somewhere where rivers flowed out from it, where a river flowed into it, and so on. And Ezekiel in chapter 28 tells us that it was up a mountain, and that's significant as we carry on then looking at this subject of the temple of God. So what happened next? Well, the next kind of clear temple is the tabernacle, isn't it? There is then this long gap between the garden temple and the tabernacle in the days of Moses. That, of course, was the temporary structure that later became the permanent structure in the temple in the days of Solomon. But then there was this, as I say, large gap, many, many years, many generations, thousands of years between these things, between the garden temple and the tabernacle. So what happened in between? Well, generally, of course, we look at, you know, the major events with the expansion of man, the first murder, the multiplication of wickedness, the flood, then the building the Tower of Babel, and finally the call of Abraham and the patriarchal period. But for our kind of consideration then this evening, I'd just like to kind of ask the question, well, how then did man meet with God during this period? Well, it seemed clear that there wasn't then a single place. Man was banned from Eden. There was no tabernacle or temple. But what we have then is, time after time, man from his side, and then God, as it were, from his side, linking up. There's movement from both sides, isn't there? So from man's side, we read of men calling on the name of the Lord, and we read of men offering sacrifices. From Abel through Noah and so on, we have burnt offerings being made as men seek to worship God, to call upon him, and shown awareness, therefore, after the fall, that worship of God and any kind of attempt to meet with him needs bloodshedding, that there needs to be atonement because of the reality now of sin. And associated with this calling and this sacrifice is then also the building of altars. We have Noah, for example, after the flood, building an altar. So there are this phenomenon from the side of man of trying to meet with God, of trying to access God, of trying to engage God in fellowship. And of course there is an engagement, but there isn't a single place. It's episodic. There's no single place or time. There's no calendar or anything. And then from the Lord's side, we have him coming and speaking and communicating, don't we? He comes, for example, to Noah, and he tells him that he's got to build this ark, and the reasons for it. He gives them instructions about it and so on. He meets with other patriarchs. He speaks to them. And we don't know for sure exactly how that worked, whether it was kind of internal speech in the heads or whether it was external speech that they heard the Lord, like you're hearing me now. The example of Samuel later on suggests it was probably the latter, that they heard God speaking like, you hear me. But certainly the Lord came from time to time and he spoke with people. And the examples that we have in Scripture are not necessarily exhaustive. The Lord may have come at other times to commune and to communicate with man. And on certain occasions, there was clearly more than words, wasn't it? There were those special appearings, the so-called theophanies, the special appearances of God. Mysterious appearances, like when he came in that kind of burning cauldron to Abraham. He appears in the burning bush to Moses. There are these times then when the Lord then does more than merely speak, when he seems to open himself up more to man, make himself more literally visible and there with man. But again, these are fleeting and they are very limited, aren't they? And there are just three examples I'd like to sort of draw your attention to in particular through this period, because I think they help us throw some light on this subject then of the temple of God. The first is the Tower of Babel. You don't need to turn to it because I think we're all familiar with the episode. But the Tower of Babel then is when, you know, men then refuse to do as the Lord has said, to obey him and spread out of the earth. And so they seek to build this temple, this huge structure. And of course, you know, there's a lot to learn from it, the way the Lord sort of looks down at man's feeble attempts and so on. But what's interesting, I think, is what men are trying to do. What's their concept? Well, their concept is they're trying to get into heaven, isn't it? That's what they say. We're going to build this structure and we're going to get into heaven. And it seems to me, and not only to me, but to others, that this reflects a knowledge going back to Eden that there was a place there in the beginning where heaven and earth met, where man could meet with God, where there was a link between heaven and earth. And in this concept, then they think, foolishly of course, but they think, you know, if we can build high enough, we'll get up there. We will break through, as it were, into heaven, because they've inherited this concept. There was an interesting film a few years ago, a sort of satire on so-called reality TV called The Truman Show. I don't know if anybody saw it, seen The Truman Show. But in The Truman Show, the idea was that there was this character, Truman, who was, since the time he was born, was on television, on the air every day, 24 hours a day. His life was the ultimate reality TV. And everybody in his life were actors apart from him. And he didn't know that he was, you know, on a TV set the whole of his life. But in the film, he begins to realise, he thinks, this thing's a bit odd here. Why am I never allowed to travel very far? And this kind of thing. So eventually he sets out to think, I think, you know, there's something funny going on. And he kind of walks across and he finds actually the sea that's supposed to be, you know, isn't very deep. And he's kind of wading across the sea. And then he reaches the edge of the set and he's kind of knocking on the sky, as it were, and then he finds a door that he can open to get through out of his world into what the rest of us are. And it seemed to me that the what's in Babel is a bit like that. They're sort of building this thing, and they think, well, if we'll just get up there, and we'll open up, and we'll get into heaven. And I think it's the point for the temple concept is that there is this join then that they have. I think they've inherited this knowledge that there was a link between heaven and earth. Again, then, if you think of the episode of Jacob at what he then called Bethel in chapter 28 of Genesis. He's, you remember, fleeing from his brother, having cheated him, outwitted him again. So he's fleeing from his brother, but also with the blessing of his parents to go and seek a wife from within the clan. And as he's running away, then he reaches this place and he lies down for the night, he puts his head on a stone, and he has a kind of theophany, doesn't he? He sees heaven opened, and he sees a ladder or a staircase to heaven, and he sees the Lord there. And there's this place then where heaven and earth are joined, and there's angels going up and down on it. And again, it's Jacob's interpretation that's interesting, isn't it? Because he says, you know, surely this is the dwelling place of God. This is the house of God. He calls that's what he says. So I'm going to call this place Bethel, the house of God, because this is the place where, or a place, where there is this link, this house, this place where I can come and meet with God. Now, again, of course, it was temporary, but it's the concept, I think, of, you know, a link where heaven and earth can be brought together, where man can have access, kind of an immediate access to the presence of God that was lost in the Garden of Eden. And then the third episode is in Exodus 24, and if you could just turn then to the book of Exodus in chapter 24. So Exodus 24. So the Israelites, obviously having come out of Egypt, have reached Mount Sinai. The Lord's thundered. He's come down on the mountain in this great theophany. He's appeared and he's spoken. He's given the Ten Commandments. But now he's calling a fellowship meal with leaders from Israel. And so he asked Moses, you know, to prepare the people and so on, but to bring up 70 elders and then also himself, Aaron, Nadab and Abihu from the priesthood to come up to the Lord on the mountain. So from verse 12. Then we read, the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and stay here, and I will give you the tablets of stone with the law and commands I've written for their instruction. Then Moses set out. Oh, sorry, I've gone too far ahead, so I should have gone back to verse 9. Moses and Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, and the 70 elders of Israel went up and saw the God of Israel. Under his feet was something like a pavement made of sapphire, clear as the sky itself. But God did not raise his hand against these leaders of the Israelites. They saw God, and they ate and drank. And the Lord said to Moses, come up to me on the mountain and stay here, and I will give you the tablets of stone with the law and the commands I've written for their instruction. And then down to verse 15, when Moses went up on the mountain, the Lord covered it. And the glory of the Lord settled on Mount Sinai. And for 6 days the cloud covered the mountain. On the seventh day the Lord called to Moses from within the cloud. To the Israelites the glory of the Lord looked like a consuming fire on top of the mountain. Then Moses entered the cloud as he went up on the mountain. And he stayed on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights. So we have then this covenant meal where the Lord calls these leaders up. And that they go up the mountain again. They're up on a mountain and they see God, don't they? They see the Lord seated on his throne, and we have this this pavement, this expanse like sapphire, clear as the sky itself. And this is the language that we have elsewhere, isn't it? With in Ezekiel, the chariot throne of the Lord has this kind of crystal shining expanse with the Lord's throne above it. It's the language of the sea in the book of Revelation, with a throne before a kind of sea. This is this is where the Lord then is, as it were, seated just above where the elders are. So they were with him, and they can see into heaven. They can see into heaven and commune and enjoy then this fellowship meal with the Lord. But then Moses is actually called up higher, isn't he? Moses is called up further up the mountain. Come up to me on the mountain and stay here, says the Lord. And he calls him up into the mountain, and he disappears out of sight into the cloud where the Lord's dwelling in his glory, into the theophanic appearance of God himself. So what's going on? Well, I don't know. What do you think, you know, when you think of, you know, these books that we're reading here, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus and so on, which we know were given to Moses by the Lord, and in particular then of this second half of the book of Exodus, how was this given to Moses? You know, he's gone up and God has given it to him, as we know, on Mount Sinai. So how do you picture this happening? Do you think that sort of Moses is kind of sitting down and the Lord's dictating to him just what we have in the book, or does the Lord just give him general instructions? Well, what I think was happening, you see, is that Moses is taken into heaven. Moses goes up into heaven and sees heavenly realities. And, of course, he is asked to copy these heavenly realities, isn't he? To make the tabernacle. I mean, that's the essence of the tabernacle and the temple, that it is a copy of heaven. So, for example, in chapter 25 and verse 40, Moses has now gone up. He's there these 40 days and 40 nights. And the Lord then says to Moses, and we have these following chapters here, 25 verse 40, then the Lord says, "See that you make them," at the moment referring directly to the lampstand, the table with the bread of the presence and the ark of the covenant. Says, "See that you make them according to the pattern shown you on the mountain." Or again in chapter 26 and verse 30, "Set up the tabernacle." He's now been given a lot of instructions about all the furnishings of the tabernacle. So he says, "Set up the tabernacle according to the plan shown you on the mountain." So he's not merely given instructions, he's actually shown things here. So I think he's shown heavenly realities, which he then has to copy to form a dwelling place, a copy of heaven on earth, which is the tabernacle and then later the temple. It's something that, of course, is repeatedly stated in Hebrews, isn't it? As the writer looks back to these events, he says Moses was just making copies of the heavenly realities. And that's what we have. Then we have Moses then, again, it's on a mountain. He goes up a mountain, and there's this sort of join heaven and earth together. And Moses, I think, actually is allowed to see heavenly things and copy them, or take instructions to have them copied. And so what we have then in these following chapters, as we know, following sort of six chapters through to 31, is then these copies that Moses is to make, laid out for us, that the tabernacle, its furnishings, with its pieces of furniture, the material that's to be used and so on, incense, we have the priestly garments, everything that's to be used to make the tabernacle, which is then a copy of heaven to be placed on earth, so that again man can have access to the presence of God on earth. And so what was the tabernacle like? Well, it was of course beautiful in different ways. The temple, the rest of this evening, we'll look at the tabernacle, but we will come back, God willing, to consider it again in our next study. But just to get an overview then of the tabernacle was beautiful in its proportions. If you're scientific, it had a kind of mathematical beauty to it. It was proportioned in different ways, but its basic setup. So you have, you know, the main courtyard then, which was 100 cubits long on the east-west axis, opening, of course, on the east. You have it 50 cubits wide, and it's 5 cubits high. A cubit, I understand, was about a foot and a half. So it was about 7.5 feet high, the curtain around the edge, meaning, of course, that nobody could look in, or unless you were a giant, you couldn't look over the top. So it was kind of cut off. And then within this large courtyard was this much smaller tent or tabernacle, which was this two-room structure. It was 30 cubits along the same axis. It was 10 cubits only wide, which isn't very wide at all, 15 feet wide. And of course it was 10 cubits high as well. And the two rooms, as you know, were the holy place, the larger one, which was 20 metres of the length, and it was 20, 10 by 10. And then you have the most holy place, which was, of course, the cubic structure, 10 cubits by 10 cubits by 10 cubits. And one of the interesting observations that Vern Poythress makes when he comments on this in a book that's very interesting, I know one or two of you have read it, it's called The Shadow of Christ in the Law of Moses. Well worth reading, but an observation he has, which is right, is that when you read carefully, what you find actually is the tabernacle itself is suspended; it's not actually on the ground. None of the curtains touch the ground; they're all on these golden poles, which hold it up actually off the earth, suggesting, you know, that it is not supposed to be actually be in contact with earth. It's this kind of heavenly copy suspended above the earth. But the room ends, these rooms and the tabernacle layout in this basic form are beautifully proportioned. Of course, it has these key six pieces of furniture, for want of a better term. There's the two bronze ones out in the courtyard. So there's the large bronze altar for the burnt offerings. It's called the altar of burnt offerings. And there's the sea of water. It was much larger in the temple later. It was a huge structure. The portable one in the tabernacle was, of course, much smaller. But it was a pool structure for containing water, or structure containing pool of water. And then there were the four golden pieces of furniture within the tabernacle, weren't they? That's, of course, significant. We go from the bronze on the earth outside to the beautiful gold within the tabernacle that is itself the heavenly copy. So we have then in the outer room, the holy place, we have the bread, the table with the bread of the presence on the north side, the candelabra with the seven lights on the southern side, and then at the entrance, just at the edge between the holy place and the curtain that divides it from the most holy place, is the altar of incense. And then within the most holy place is, of course, the Ark of the Covenant with the gold covering over it, the atonement cover, and the two cherubim, copies of the cherubim there. And we have then there in the most holy place, of course, copies of cherubim, because what we see in, you know, Ezekiel with the throne chariot, what we see in heaven in Revelation and so on, is that cherubim are there in the presence of God, aren't they? That's where they are. That's why we have copies of them in the most holy place. But it's not only that there are these two large golden cherubim in this inner sanctuary, the holiest place of all. When you read, of course, they're woven into the fabric, aren't they, inside the tent. The tent fabric then, which significantly was blue, it was this beautiful blue fabric inside, which had sort of flecks, it seems, of red, sort of purpley red on it. Some of the colours are a bit difficult to translate, but it seems clear it was blue. And therefore, you remember that there was this sort of blue sky colour when you go up into heaven. It's a sort of blue inside, when you can see into it where the Lord dwells. So it seems that, you know, this is why it's blue. It's a copy of heaven with this sort of blue inside. And woven into then this beautiful blue fabric inside the tabernacle then are lots and lots of cherubim, representing, of course, the cherubim in the real heaven of which this is a copy. And also, when you read in this and in the temple, is that as well as the cherubim, you have then lots of trees and plants that are woven into fabric and in the I can't remember. I think they're painted on the sort of cedar that makes up the temple. But you have these trees and these plants, and botanically, what exactly they were, I'm not sure we know. But that's not the point. You can see the point is that there are trees in there. And why are there trees in there? Because there's this looking back to Eden as well. Not me only, but I think that. A lot of other people say, well, we have, yes, it's a heavenly copy, but Eden was heaven on earth. Eden was where there were the trees. So we have the trees in this copy again, reminding them of what was lost, but also of what there is in the future to come when, again, heaven is restored perfectly on earth. So we have these features inside, the beautiful golden objects and things we're going to consider next time, so I'm not going to say anything more about them today, just trying to help us get a head around the basic setup here of this tabernacle. And the fact that it is a copy of heaven, but also then, I think, looks back to Eden. And inside then it was woven in this beautiful blue fabric, but then, of course, it was covered, wasn't it? There were all these coverings of these animals that we don't quite know what they were, sort of goat skin sort of covering over it. And then there was an outer other covering of sea cows or porpoises or whatever those creatures were. But most people think the idea was that this pipe provided some kind of waterproof covering. I'm not sure how much they needed waterproofing in that part of the world, but that's what's said. But the point is that if you were outside then, all you could see, when you went into the courtyard to worship, you'd see this kind of pretty nondescript structure, wouldn't you? You'd see all this kind of, sea cow hides covering it. You didn't see the beauty inside it. You didn't see this, you know, lovely blue and all this golden furniture inside. What you saw was this kind of covering of hides of sea cows on the outside. And people often, and I think, you know, I think rightly, because we know then that Jesus is the true temple, see, you know, something there in that, in the significance of that. That he, you know, on his outward appearance was nondescript, as it were. He looked like the rest of us. Nobody went around, sort of, you could, you know, oh yeah, that's Jesus over there, because, you know, he was glowing or something. He looked like everybody else. He didn't look any different. But inwardly, of course, the Lord was there. He is the Lord, dwelling in this fleshly body that hid the glory of his presence. And the tabernacle setup seems to, you know, teach that in its typology, that you have this nondescript, ordinary outside that doesn't give you any indication, that inside is this beautiful heavenly copy, but of course where the Lord also dwelled. And that's, of course, what I haven't touched on, the fact that the Lord dwelled there. At the end, when this copy, this tabernacle was set up, and at the end of the book of Exodus, we read of the glory of the Lord coming within that tabernacle to dwell there, within the most holy place especially. And one interesting thing when, you know, you read around this, if you want to read around this, is that people say, boy, it must have been really dark in there. Wasn't it dark? Because you've got, you see, you've got this out, you've got this blue fabric, and then you've got this covering of these thick hides, and then you've got this other covering of all these kind of dolphin skins, or whatever exactly they were. So was there any light inside at all? And people will point out, I'll say, you know, there was that, there was the candlestick. There was a seven-headed candlestick. But it would still not have been very bright in there, if that alone was the light. You know, and I think that the Lord dwelled in there, and his light lit up that the rooms inside, so that, you know, those who were priests, who were allowed that close, they weren't kind of fumbling around in the darkness, as it were. That they had this light from the presence of the Lord in that tabernacle, because we know he dwelt there. And he appeared to speak, you know, to Moses. He could speak to Moses from within this structure. And he would come out, of course, when the Israelites were to march forth. They would be led by the Lord coming out, as it were, as a great king to lead them forward. He would come out from his heavenly dwelling on earth to lead forth his people. So this is, I think, the basic setup then of this tabernacle, and which becomes copied, as I say, in the temple. Everything's double the size in the temple, but the concepts, the setup is basically the same. The tabernacle and temple both being copies of heaven. And as we conclude then, we'll just turn, I've referred to the book of Hebrews. If you could turn to the book of Hebrews. So just in chapter 8 and verse 2, read then of Jesus, well, start in 8 verse 1, I think. We do not have such a high priest. Well, we do have such a high priest who sat down at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, and who serves in the sanctuary, he's in heaven, in the sanctuary, the true tabernacle set up by the Lord, not by man. So he's in the true one, the heavenly sanctuary, of which the earthly one is a copy. 9 verse 11, when Christ came as high priest of the good things that are already here, he went through the greater and more perfect tabernacle that is not man-made, that is to say, not a part of this creation. He's gone into the heavenly tabernacle, the real one, of which this earthly one, as I've been saying, is a copy. Now, it's rather mysterious. I'm not quite sure what it means, but it's not part of this creation. If it's not part of this creation, how can it not be God himself? I don't know. Is it some other creation? I don't know. But it's certainly distinguished then from, the clear point is that it's distinguished from the earthly structure, which was a copy of it given to Moses, who I think, as we see in Exodus, went into heaven to copy this. And so in chapter 9 and verse 23, finally, we read then, it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these sacrifices. But the heavenly things, these realities then, with better sacrifices than these. For Christ did not enter a man-made sanctuary that was only a copy of the true one. He entered heaven itself, now to appear for us in God's presence. He entered then the true sanctuary, the real one, of which then the sanctuary we've been considering, the tabernacle that Moses had set up and the temple, were copies. And it was all a kind of a copy, it was all an imitation, but nonetheless, the Lord really dwelled there. That was the great privilege that those people had, that the Lord of glory, the King of Kings, did dwell with his people. He was amongst them, so that unlike the patriarchs and so on before, who had no single place to go, there was a single place where they could go to worship God and enjoy access to his presence in the tabernacle and then later in the temple. That was their privilege. But then, as the writer here in Hebrews is keen to point out, our privilege is so much greater, isn't it? Our privilege is that, you know, we're not going to this copy. We in Jesus are allowed access to the heavenly realities. One day we will be there in full reality, as it were, in these or our renewed bodies. But at the moment in Jesus, by our faith union with him, then we can enter heaven itself, where he has gone before us to open the way to where the Lord lives. And so that's our privilege then in him, the true temple, to enter there into heaven. Okay, let's move to prayer.